We were talking about the end of the Mackey administration here at Michigan State. Dr. DiBiagio, as president, how long were you provost under?
1 year.
1 year, yeah. And then you were running into the university's mandate of 65 and out. Is that still policy still in effect?
I don't know.
Oh. I don't know either.
I had really pretty much made the commitment to myself and also to my wife that I was going to accept the concept of leaving the position of provost when I became 65. I probably would have left earlier if it hadn't been for the fact that there were smoke signals that things were going in an unfortunate direction toward the last year or so of Cecil's presidency. So when Cecil announced that he was going to be leaving the position, and when the search and selection process proceeded and resulted in the selection of John DiBiagio, again, I don't remember the timeline exactly, but it was at least a few months before John was to come and become the president, that he got in communication with me, and he and I had some meetings and talked about the future of the Office of the Provost, and I indicated to him that, under the policy, I should leave that position, and that, as a matter of fact, that would be a congenial thing for both my wife and me to have that change. And John indicated that he would not want to have to conduct a search for a provost as an immediate challenge.
I see.
So he thought that was all very fortunate, coming together of several different parameters. And so he and I agreed that I would leave. Actually, I was going to leave at the end of the fiscal year, David Scott didn't want to have to do the budget presentation with the board and the board subcommittees and one thing or another. So I stayed on an extra month. So.
I see. And was David Scott your associate?
Yes.
At associate provost. Right. And so there was a natural progression.
Yeah. Well, there was a national search and all that. But, David Scott is such a talent that it was sort of a foregone conclusion, at least as far as I was concerned.
Pretty strong resume.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's an internationally renowned nuclear scientist who had been brought here as a Hanna professor and eventually agreed to be associate provost. Who was going to be a stronger candidate than that?
But that's true, especially in the intellectual.
But the search was honest. I mean, there's nothing phony about it.
And then after you left as provost, did you return to teaching or?
Yes.
Okay, and back in psychology.
Yes, as I became fond of saying. I was promoted from provost to rank and file faculty member. Walter Adams used to talk about the rank and file faculty members. I took up his phrase.
You were promoted to that. Had students changed in the the duration from when you? Yeah. Did you teach at all when you were provost, as you were provost, did you teach some classes or? I know you're not that your time wasn't busy enough.
I suppose in a technical sense, I can say I did. I supervised some graduate students in the psychological.
Oh, I see.
I didn't teach.
So you kept courses. Did keep some research activities going.
Graduate education activities.
Mm-hmm. The and so how would you say that students changed in the duration from the 20 years or so you were involved in administration?
Let me go way back, okay? My first faculty appointment was at Stanford. And the undergraduate student body at Stanford was small and extraordinarily highly qualified. I mean, their freshman class would have something like 80 to 90% high school class valedictorians.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And in those ancient days at Stanford, there was the concept of the gentleman's see. A lot of grading was on the curve for undergraduates, especially freshmen, sophomores at Stanford back then. And the sort of the lore that goes with that is that these people who had been so intensely high achievers in high school came to Stanford and they decided that they were perfectly capable of going out and commanding a desirable career and a high income without excessive expenditure of intellectual effort.
The gentleman said.
So there was a certain percentage of even that elite undergraduate student body who really did not show much interest in things intellectual or in a high level of learning achievement. But it was very much, it had this flavor that I can do what I want to do in life without going through that. And obviously it was tough. I mean, if you're going to be in the top 10% of that undergraduate student body there, you really did have your work cut out for you. Now, so it's sort of students who were truly intrigued by learning as contrasted with students who were not investing very much in learning. They were learning enough to pass, to get the C, but that was about it. When I came back to being a rank and file faculty member after leaving the position of provost, the thing that surprised me more than anything else was the intense focus of, I would say, a clear majority and maybe the overwhelming majority of undergraduates in getting the certificate of graduating from college.
The ticket, yeah.
That was it. And they would do whatever was absolutely necessary in order to be able to earn the baccalaureate degree, in order to receive the baccalaureate degree. And that was really somewhat dismaying to me. But I want to add immediately, there was another percentage. It varied depending on the particular course and the particular semester or quarter. There were 15 or 20 or 30% of the students in each class that I taught who were interested in learning. I mean, they really were intrigued by getting to know more. Mm-hmm. And that was enough for me.
Enough to keep it going. Well, I had a similar experience. It had been quite a few years when I started here where I hadn't taught an honors course. And when I taught an honors course, it was like night and day. And not that we didn't have some in the regular courses that weren't, but I was pleasantly surprised by that too. Yeah. What courses did you teach when you came back? There were graduate courses, but...
No, I...
Or did you teach the regular?
I taught not the introductory course, but the first level course on personality.
Oh, okay.
In those days, it was Psychology 225. Mm-hmm. And I taught a senior level course on theories of personality, a 400 level course.
Did you have a favorite teaching technique that you preferred to use? And that always worked well?
I was sort of stuck with my own personal history.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I really firmly believe that significant learning can occur, I'll say it in extreme form, sort of regardless of the teaching technique. When I was an assistant professor just starting my career at Stanford, I taught what in those days was Psych 1 in the education auditorium, which was the largest seating arrangement used as a classroom on the Stanford campus, mm-hmm. to groups of 350 to 450 students without a microphone, with a chalkboard that rolled onto the stage, mm-hmm. and a chunk of chalk that was about an inch in diameter.
No teaching toys.
And I think that a lot of those students learned a good deal about psychology under those circumstances. Now, you know, they had to put in more effort, mm-hmm. but in those days they did it, and, you know, it worked. So my favorite teaching technique, I taught fairly large enrollment sections of 225, you know, 150, 200, 250. And the senior level course, I did ask them to limit that to 40. That way we could have some amount of sort of Socratic dialogue. But I guess, you know, and it's all said and done, the most enjoyable and the most instructive teaching for me was graduate seminars, where we had, you know, 8, 10, 15 mm-hmm. graduate students. We all sat around a table, and I came in with my 3x5 index card that had the list of topics that I wanted us to discuss during the meeting that day. And mm-hmm. we talked.
Mm-hmm. As so. A seminar should be. Well, one of the things in this project that we're trying to do is not just administrative, but we're dealing with some of the faculty and their experiences and how it changed in the last 50 years, because it seems like that is an important theme of the last 50 years of MSU, how the faculty have approached the issue of teaching, what they've done. So that's why I've been asking consistently, favorite teaching or successful teaching techniques in that.
The research on teaching and learning that I know about, which is not necessarily up to the minute, but the strongest variable in terms of student achievement is the orderliness and organization that the instructor brings to the classroom, mm-hmm. whatever the so-called teaching method.
Mm-hmm. So if it's...
That's my bias. But if, you know, it's not really overwhelmingly important whether it's a large, medium, or small enrollment course, whether it's beginning, medium, or advanced, mm-hmm. But the main thing that the instructor can bring to the situation is, first of all, expert knowledge, and second, careful, advanced planning. You know, in the elementary level, they always talk about lesson plans.
Lesson plans, right.
Well, you know, good lesson plans in that sense, knowing what you're going to emphasize, thinking about the cognitive strategies for helping people to understand the concepts and how those concepts apply to events. That's what really makes the difference, in my opinion.
When did you finally retire?
From when did I finally retire? My official retirement date.
That's what I'm interested in.
June 30, 1991.
Have you been active in any activities since 91 for the university or yes. special projects? What are some of those things that you've been doing?
Well, before I retired, after I had become a rank and file faculty member, I was enjoying myself in the peace and quiet of my old tall office. The provost came knocking on my door and said, Jim Peters has decided he's retiring as manager of the Office of Facilities Planning and Space Management. And we got to have somebody to run that show for a few months, so will you do it? Mm-hmm. And so I became the interim manager of Facilities Planning and Space Management before I retired. By the time I actually retired, the process had run its course enough so that a person who was going to be the next regularly appointed manager of that office had been selected and was ready to go to work in that arena. But she was not entirely comfortable with walking in there cold, so the decision was made that I would be appointed 10% as a consultant, and I would sort of mentor her for a while. She learned how to deal with the issues that...
Is she still in that office?
No, she left that and became part of the Office of Planning and Budgets, and then she became an assistant provost, special assistant to the president for something or other, Marty Hesse.
I see.
So I did that for a while, and things would come up in the purview of the provost where they'd want a little extra staff work done, and so I'd be asked if I'd be interested in doing something or other, you know, drafting a position paper or something or other on this or that or the other thing. And
that was Provost Simon was asking you that, or David Scott had already left by then? Or he did too?
It was really pretty much both David Scott and Luana Simon. And, meanwhile, when I retired, I decided that I wanted to continue to supervise graduate students in the psych clinic. So year by year, I became a volunteer adjunct faculty member.
I see.
Doing that, so I still am supervising two graduate students who are learning to do clinical psychology in our psych clinic. In 1995. I was sort of, I'd gone through the process actually of mentoring a second person heading up the Facilities Planning and Space Management office. The first was Marty Hesse, the second was Bill Latta. And along came the decision to establish the affiliation between the Detroit College of Law and Michigan State University. That was done, and then the problems began to arise as to what does this affiliation entail and how do you do it? So Peter McPherson and Simon asked me if I could take an interest in what I called being liaison between the law college and the university. Mm-hmm. So I did that.
I see.
That's pretty much winding down, has wound down, as of this last summer when the law college, the new dean of the law college arrived, and we had some administrative restructuring within the law college that made it more rational.
Did it help or hinder you didn't have a background in law in doing that job?
Candidly, I think it was an advantage. Now, I claim to have had a bit of background because I had served on two or three study committees over the years, a fairly intensive study committee, actually, back when I was dean of the College of Social Science, to present a proposal and analysis of what it would take to establish a college of law at Michigan State University.
Now, those discussions have continued on.
So that's gone. It's waxed and waned over the years. I did learn enough about academic law and law colleges as academic administrative units in the process of trying to do a decent job as a member of the study committee, so that I had some idea of what the academic law scene looked like, in sort of broad strokes. So I had that as sort of a general matrix within which I could begin to think about issues and problems. The advantage was that I could say to people, look, I've had no direct experience either in a college of law or administering an institution that has a college of law, and so you have to explain things to me.
I see.
And that's a very good process for getting people to think more intensively and more analytically and with sometimes some more knowledge of the things they're responsible to do than they were engaged in up to that time. So,
have you had, in these informal things, you've had some contacts with our current president, of course. How would you evaluate President McPherson?
Well, my first comment in evaluating Peter McPherson is that he was an excellent director of AID. This university awarded him an honorary doctoral degree in, I believe it was 1984. So I had some acquaintance with him by reputation. I didn't, I met him technically when he came and got his honorary degree. John Cantlin and I hooded him.
I see.
But I was prepared for Peter McPherson to bring political sophistication, a strong sense of management and administration, and considerable knowledge of an important slice of American academia to his service as president. I opposed the process that resulted in his appointment, for what little that was worth. But I suppose he knows that, but it never seemed to be an issue with him, and it isn't an issue with me. The Constitution of the state says that the Board of Trustees shall appoint a president to serve as CEO, and they did. I don't think they did it in a way that was in the best interest of the institution, but it was done. He came. And he has served with, I think, very considerable distinction. Not the least of his accomplishments is that by persuading the state political system to give us a $10.4 million increase in the so-called base appropriation, he accomplished the equivalent of about a $300 million endowment.
Because that continues year after year.
Once you get it in the base. Unless you have a crisis like the early 80s.
$300 million.
Pretty much perennial. Well, if you figure that an endowment should pay some current costs, but also you keep investing enough of the income so that you keep the purchasing power of the endowment up. A minimum of $200 million, I think more realistically about $300 million in endowment would be necessary to produce that as a steady, reliable revenue stream. So that's important. Peter has been willing to listen with great understanding and with great respect to those of us who have argued in favor of what I consider to be appropriate and sophisticated academic enterprise, particularly academic governance. He's been very effective in moving the development program forward. There was a good base in existence when he came, but he has built on that effectively. So I think Peter's been a strong plus for this institution.
He's broken the pattern of the 7-year presidency after President Hanna.
Right.
So he's now beyond that benchmark. As you look back on your career, did you anticipate when you came here in the early 1960s that you would end your career here, or that you would be here entirely during all of your academic career?
I don't think I really thought in those terms. Mm-hmm. You know, when I decided to come to Michigan State, to me the decision was that I was going to continue to invest my time and energy in developing and managing the best possible graduate program in clinical psychology that I could imagine. And I was very surprised when I decided that I would become department chairperson. I thought, you know, what the heck do I think I'm doing? But, you know, my colleagues seemed to want me to do that, and so I did it. Mm-hmm. But I still, you know, even after I moved in primarily into academic administration, I wasn't really thinking about, you know, will I stay here or not. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, along the way, I will tell you immodestly that I turned down the opportunity to head up the graduate program in clinical psychology at the University of Illinois. I turned down before I was provost here, I had offered to be provost at the University of Georgia. I was offered an endowed chair at one of the Arizona universities. It isn't as though I had done anything that would suggest to others, at least, that I was necessarily going to stay here forever.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's been a very good place for both me and my wife and our family. And each year, it has seemed to me that what I was doing was important enough to give it my fullest possible effort. So
sounds like an interesting place to end our interview. I want to thank you on behalf of the project for the time that we've spent and your sharing your insights. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope they're insights.
Thank you.
You're welcome.